early Soviet directors Sergei Eisenstein, Dziga Vertov, and Alexander Dovzhenko. But because of its political resonance, Repentance was the most important work of subversive art in the country since the publication of One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich during Khrushchev's thaw. Aburladze did not have to travel far to get the spark for Repentance. I got the inspiration from a true story, an incident that took place in a village in western Georgia, he said. A man who had been sent unjustly to prison was finally released. His entire life had been broken, destroyed. And when he came home, he found the grave of the man who had sent him to jail. One night he went into the graveyard and dug up the coffin. He opened the coffin, took out the corpse, and leaned it up against the wall. This was his act of revenge. He would not let the dead man rest. This awful fact showed us that we could show the tragedy of an entire epoch by using this device. That was the spark for the treatment and then the script. With his daughter-in-law, Nana Dzhanzelidze, Aburladze wrote an 18-page treatment and then a script in 1981 about a kind of every dictator, a tyrant named Varlam, who destroys one life after another in a time mirroring the late 1930s under Stalin. Varlam, a provincial mayor, promises to build a paradise on earth for his people. Instead, he ravages them in fits of paranoia and sheer indifference. As an old man, he even tries to shoot down the sun with a pistol. "The people need a great reality," Varlam says, echoing the twisted paternalism of Lenin and Stalin. Later, he defends his own paranoia, saying, "Of every three people, four are our enemies. Yes, do not be shocked. One enemy is greater in quantity than one friend." Varlam is so ruthless that in one scene he befriends an artist named Sandro, and then sends him off to die in the camps, declaring him guilty of individualism and friendship with anarchist poets. Sandro's daughter, haunted for decades by the memory of the martyrdom of her Christ-like father, eventually digs up the grave of Varlam and leans the corpse against the wall. She will not forget, and she will not let those around her forget. The film, which is filled with the sort of allegorical devices and local grotesques common in Fellini, is about the necessity of memory, the need not only to battle tyranny of the present, but also to deal with the insanities of the past. Varlam's son, Abel, is little better than the father. He temporizes. He repeats the sins of the father. He has no conscience, no memory. And he prosecutes Katie, the daughter of Sandro, the woman who has repeatedly dug up the grave of the tyrant. Tornike, Abel's son, cannot comprehend the life he has inherited. He rages against his father. In perhaps the most important scene in the film, Tornike confronts Abel, a battle that can be read not only as the conflict of generations, but as the singular struggle of man against power, the struggle of memory against forgetting. "Did you know all that?" Tornike asks his father.
"All what?" Abel says.
"About Grandpa."
"Grandpa never did anything wrong. Those were complicated times. It is difficult to explain now."
"What do the times have to do with it?"
"Plenty," Abel says, getting angrier. "The situation then was different. It was a question of national survival. We were surrounded by enemies who wanted to crush us. Should we have just patted their heads?"
"Was the artist Sandro Baratelli an enemy?" the boy asks.
"He was. Perhaps he was a good artist, but he failed to understand many things. I'm not saying we didn't make any mistakes, but what are a few lives when the well-being of millions is at stake? We had so much to accomplish. Look at it from that perspective."
"So you applied mathematics to human lives, with proportions paramount?" the boy says in disgust.
"Don't be sarcastic," Abel says. It's time you understood that a public official places the public interest above private considerations. Tornike's contempt for his father has deepened. A person is born human, he says. Then he becomes an official. Your head is in the clouds, Abel says. Reality is different. Varlam was guided by the interests of society. And sometimes what happened was not his doing. Tell me, says the son, would he have destroyed the entire world if so ordered? At the end of the film, Tornike shoots himself in despair. The year was 1981, and Leonid Brezhnev was general secretary, and Edward Shevardnadze was the most powerful man in Georgia. Abuladze brought the script to Shevardnadze. Shevardnadze read the script and said, "We must find a way to do this," Abuladze said. He told me, "The year 1937 was in my home, too." He was a witness to all that happened. His own father was among those arrested. I remember it all, too. I was a child, and though I cannot remember all the specifics, I remember the emotion, the fear. My father was a doctor, and he always had a suitcase ready with some clothes in it. He had nothing to do with politics, but he knew there could be a knock at the door at any time. They made the arrest, and you never returned. So Shevardnadze told us we must find a way to do something on this topic by all means, but he said it had to go through Moscow. We went to Rezo Chkaidze, the manager of the film studios, and he told Shevardnadze that there were film programs for the republics and for the entire Soviet Union. For the Republican program, all we had to do was specify the topic of the film and the name of the director. So we sent a telegram saying, "Director Tengiz Abuladze wants to make a film on a moral and ethical problem." That was all. Moscow gave its permission, saying only that the film sounded interesting. Then Shevardnadze had a good piece of advice. He told us, "The more general you keep it, the better." And so, in a way, he was an extra author to the film. Abuladze made sure that Varlam was not simply a direct analogue for Stalin. Varlam, as played by the brilliant Georgian actor Avtandil Makaradze, had a Hitlerian moustache and wore a pince-nez that immediately evoked the image of Stalin's secret police chief, Lavrenti Beria. Abuladze dressed Varlam's guards in medieval armor to deepen the sense of time. Finally, he gave Varlam the last name, Aravidze, which is a bit like Kafka's semi-anonymous K. In Georgian, there is no name, Aravidze, but the root of the word, Aravin, means no one. We wanted even the name to hint at Varlam's being the very image of the totalitarian, the dictator. Anywhere or at any time, Abuladze said. They are all in there. Stalin, of course, but also Khrushchev and Lenin, too. A friend of mine met Molotov before his death, and he told Molotov, "You know, it's a pity that Lenin died so early. If he had lived longer, everything would have been normal." But Molotov said, "Why do you say that?" My friend said, "Because Stalin was a bloodsucker and Lenin was a noble person." Molotov smiled, and then he said, "Compared to Lenin, Stalin was a mere lamb." Abuladze shot the film in 5 months in 1984. But Konstantin Chernenko, a protege of Brezhnev, was still in power. And so the film simply remained on the shelf, along with the works of dozens of other filmmakers. Soon after Chernenko died and Gorbachev came to power in March 1985, Abuladze's old friend Shevardnadze was appointed to a position on the Politburo. The prospects for repentance brightened. In the spring of 1986, Abuladze called Shevardnadze in Moscow and asked him if he could use his influence with Gorbachev to get the film shown in May at a big film festival in the capital. Shevardnadze felt a certain pang of guilt or obligation and met with Gorbachev. I owe a lot of people back home, and I can't repay them all now, Shevardnadze told Gorbachev. But there is one debt I must pay, no matter what happens, and you can help me. Shevardnadze arranged a screening of Repentance for Gorbachev. When the film was over, Gorbachev, whose grandfathers had both been imprisoned during the Stalin era, gave his approval to release the film. But a crisis intervened. The nuclear disaster at Chernobyl. The decision had to be put off. At around the same time, L.M. Klimov, a director and the new head of the Filmmakers Union, set up a conflict commission as a way to move some of those many films that had been banned under previous Soviet leaders off the shelf and onto the screen. Klimov realized that the themes of Aboladze's Repentance were so explosive that it would require a decision at the highest level. He went to the liberal ideologist of reforms, Alexander Yakovlev. Yakovlev was astonished by Repentance and called Aboladze into his office and revealed his plan. They would leak the film, showing it first to limited audiences in carefully selected venues. Then they would slowly increase the number of screenings, creating a certain inevitability about Repentance. As it turned out, the interplay between the screenings of Repentance and the timing of major political events was uncanny. In October 1986, there were several showings of the film, mainly for audiences of well-connected intellectuals in Moscow, Tbilisi, and other major cities. Then in January 1987, Gorbachev presided over a breakthrough plenum of the Central Committee, at which he gave the clearest indication yet that he was preparing a radical reform of the political and economic systems. Filled with self-confidence now, Gorbachev returned to the public stage a month later, this time telling a gathering of journalists and writers at the Kremlin that the blank spots of history must be filled in. "We must not forget names," Gorbachev said. "And it is all the more immoral to forget or pass over in silence large periods in the life of the people. History must be seen for what it is." Repentance played in thousands of theaters. Millions saw it, including the young man named Dima Yorosov. After he'd been fired from his job in the archives of the Supreme Court, Yorosov had been working as a laborer, unloading trucks at a printing plant. The film helped raise his spirits. Now it seemed to him that change was no longer an empty promise. Yorosov discovered that he was not alone in his quest to learn more about the past. Groups of Moscow intellectuals, most of them old enough to remember the promise and the collapse of the thaw, began organizing discussion groups and public forums. With the sponsorship of Alexander Yakovlev, Yuri Afanasyev was appointed director of the Historical Archives Institute. Afanasyev quickly launched a public campaign arguing for a radical revision of Soviet history and organized a series of lectures on the Stalin era. He invited scholars and the survivors of the purges to come forward at last and speak. Yorosov, for his part, began thinking that he might legalize the work he had begun long ago in the stacks of the archives. He wanted to show people what he had done so far. He wanted their help to expand his collection of the names of the lost. He started going to these lectures and discussion groups, if only to be closer to people who had lived the life he had been reading about in the archives. On April 13, 1987, Yorosov went to an evening of remembrance at the Central House of Writers. The first few speakers gave guarded talks about the crimes of the past. This was an older generation, one accustomed to using a language that hinted at truth, then retreated. They were trained in the art of euphemism and allegory. Their most direct complaint was about the lack of information. Dima felt frustrated, stifled. Just before people got ready to leave, he asked for the floor and got it. With the angry, put-upon look of a petulant rock and roller, Yorosov described his work. He said he had collected 123,000 file cards of information from his own subterranean research. He said he knew from experience that there were at least 16 million files in the archives covering arrests and executions. When he was rummaging in the files, Yurasov told the audience, he had discovered a confidential letter from the chairman of the Supreme Court of the USSR to Khrushchev, reporting that between 1953 and 1957, 600,000 people, who had been executed during the Stalin era, had been rehabilitated posthumously. Another 612,500, Yurasov said, were rehabilitated between 1963 and 1967. He described how, from 1929 on, all anti-Soviet crimes, the general term used during the purges and after, were recorded on a huge index card file in the archives of the Interior Ministry. I have statistical material, Yurasov said. Not complete, of course, but it gives a general idea. The crowd was astonished, not only by the numbers, but by Yurasov's access to them and his precision. One of the evening's main speakers, an older historian, took the microphone after Dima sat down and said the young man clearly knows much more than I do, and I expect more than anyone else in the hall. I am very grateful to him. As the crowd was leaving the hall, one member of the audience asked Yurasov if he really thought his sincerity would lead to anything. Well, he said, it will soon become clear whether a perestroika has begun or whether it's merely words again. In the summer of 1987, Gorbachev and Alexander Yakovlev began drafting a speech on history that would be delivered at a jubilee celebrating the 70th anniversary of the October Revolution. This speech would involve one of the most difficult rounds of political and rhetorical maneuvering in Gorbachev's career. To begin with, Gorbachev himself was still convinced of what he called the rightness of the socialist choice. He continued to see Lenin as his guiding intellectual and historical model. There is absolutely no evidence to suggest that Gorbachev was out to undermine, much less destroy, the basic tenets of ideology or statehood of the Soviet Union. Certainly not in 1987. He also knew well that the Central Committee, the Politburo, and regional party committees were dominated by men whose careers and very being were based on the persistence of a fossilized view of the world, one that did not challenge too hard the official version of Soviet history. The necessity of the brutal collectivization and industrialization campaigns, the glory of Stalin's leadership in the war. To keep his hold on power, Gorbachev could begin with only small doses of truth. In the summer and fall of 1987, the Politburo held numerous sessions on how best to approach the Revolution Day speech. Gorbachev had little choice but to play a game of strategy and euphemism. The Communist Party was not only the most powerful political constituency in the country, it was the only one. What later became known as the Democratic Opposition hardly existed. The broad range of pro-reform forces, from the former dissidents like Andrei Sakharov to the early informal groups like Democratic Perestroika, all put their hopes in Gorbachev. That was where the power was, and they wanted to keep it that way. Gorbachev faced a Politburo in which the committed reformers were a minority of four. Gorbachev, Yeltsin, Yakovlev, and Edward Shevardnadze. Hardliners like Yegor Ligachev and moderate conservatives like Nikolai Ryzhkov were in the clear majority. It would be foolish to think that the conservatives then were any less conservative than the people who led the August coup, Shevardnadze told me. Every word of the history speech was a potential battle, a political war. Yakovlev told me that when Gorbachev passed around a proposed draft, a majority of the members of the Politburo insisted that Gorbachev not call Stalin criminal. On that question, Gorbachev exercised his option and overruled his colleagues. In October, Gorbachev went before the entire Central Committee in a closed plenary session for a trial run of the November speech. Like Khrushchev in 1956, Gorbachev gave specific figures to describe the Stalinist terror. How 10 of the 13 old Bolshevik revolutionaries who survived until 1937 were purged. How 1,108 of the 1,966 delegates to the 1934 Party Congress and 70% of the Central Committee were eliminated. How thousands of Red Army commanders, the flower of the army on the eve of Hitler's aggression, were killed. How the triumphs of the war came in spite of, and not because of, Stalin's leadership. As he recited this bloody litany, Gorbachev noticed a kind of disturbed murmuring in the crowd. Breaking off from his text, he retreated slightly. "Comrades," he said, "please bear in mind that not everything I have stated here will go into the Jubilee speech in detailed form. It will include only general overall assessments of the complex periods in our history. Sometime before the anniversary and the public speech, Ligachev rang Gorbachev on the phone. Ligachev told me that his and his wife's families had been wounded by the Stalinist purges, and yes, he too supported the screenings of repentance. But now he was beginning to fear that a strong speech from the General Secretary would blacken Soviet history. 'This would mean canceling our entire lives,' Ligachev told Gorbachev in a rage. 'We are opening the way for people to spit on our history.' Gorbachev knew his prerogatives, but he also recognized the delicate balance of power. At the end of the Central Committee plenum, one of the strongest supporters of reform, Boris Yeltsin, resigned in a fury, accusing Ligachev of bullying and even Gorbachev of creating a cult of personality that permitted too little disagreement within the Politburo. Yeltsin's resignation, and the furious ritual denunciations that followed, made it clear that Gorbachev was operating in a political environment that he would one day compare to a lake of gasoline. In the coming months, as minutes of the plenum became public, people would learn just how volatile, even vicious, the atmosphere in the party leadership could be. Even Yakovlev and Shevardnadze felt compelled to join the hardliners in heaping abuse on Yeltsin. Gorbachev, too, showed little mercy. One day Yeltsin's bravado would be made to order for the historical moment. One day the hardliners would refuse to be manipulated and would launch a counterattack, first political, then military. That would be Yeltsin's moment. But now, as Gorbachev tried to manipulate the historical debate, subtlety and compromise were required. Yes, Gorbachev would spit on Stalin, but carefully. On November 2, 1987, at the Kremlin's Palace of Congresses, Gorbachev delivered his speech to a national television audience and the great relics of the communist world. Erich Honecker of East Germany, Wojciech Jaruzelski of Poland, Fidel Castro of Cuba, Daniel Ortega of Nicaragua, Milos Jakeš of Czechoslovakia, Nicolae Ceaușescu of Romania, Gorbachev's own Central Committee. They were all there to hear what would and would not be said about the history of the regime. Soon all of them would fall to revolution and election, all but Castro, and in large part the reason was this speech. Bland, hedged, filled with the Communist Party newspeak imagined by George Orwell and perfected by committees of cowardly men, Gorbachev's speech nevertheless opened the gate, and the lion of history came roaring in. To read it now, just a few years later, the speech seems like a relic from another world, an ideological incantation in which the descendants of the tyrant pay annual tribute to the past and the rightness of the party's course. Dear comrades, esteemed foreign guests, 7 decades separate us from the unforgettable days of October 1917. from those legendary days that became the starting point of a new epoch of human progress and the true history of mankind. October is truly mankind's hour of genius and its morning dawn. The year 1917 showed that the choice between socialism and capitalism is the main social alternative of our age, and that there is no way to advance in the 20th century without moving toward a higher form of social organization, to socialism. Only many paragraphs and rounds of applause later came the hint of real purpose, an almost apologetic break with the tone of ritual celebration. If today we look into our history with an occasionally critical gaze, Gorbachev said, it is only because we want to get a better, a fuller idea of our path into the future. Gorbachev was in a pathetic patch here, and when he turned explicitly to Stalin, he promised even-handedness, a balanced view. To stay faithful to historical truth, we have to see both Stalin's indisputable contribution to the struggle for socialism, to the defense of its gains, and the gross political mistakes and the abuses committed by him and his circle, for which our people paid a heavy price, and which had grave consequences for society. Gorbachev even paid tribute to the notion of a determinist course of history and the very kind of historical thinking in the short course. Looking at history through sober eyes and taking into account the totality of domestic and international realities, there is no avoiding the question. Could a course have been chosen in those conditions other than that put forward by the party? If we wish to remain true to historic method and to life itself, there can be only one answer. No, it could not. Only one answer possible. The applause was deafening. But then came the reason for all this bilge, a moment of candor that Khrushchev in 1956 could only venture in secret. Finally, a Soviet leader had come before the public, before millions watching on television, to speak a few paragraphs of truth. It is perfectly obvious that the lack of the proper level of democratization of Soviet society was precisely what made possible both the cult of personality and the violations of the law, arbitrariness, and the repressions of the 30s. To be blunt, real crimes based on the abuse of power. Many thousands of members of the party and non-members were subjected to mass repressions. That, comrades, is the bitter truth. Serious damage was done to the cause of socialism and the authority of the party. And we must speak bluntly about this. This is essential for the final and irreversible assertion of Lenin's ideal of socialism. The guilt of Stalin and those close to him before the party and the people for the mass repressions and lawlessness that were permitted are immense and unforgivable. Even now we still encounter attempts to ignore sensitive questions of our history, to hush them up, to pretend that nothing special happened. We cannot agree with this. It would be a neglect of historical truth, disrespect for the memory of those who found themselves innocent victims of lawlessness and arbitrariness. A few paragraphs submerged in this great stew. As if to save himself, to avoid going too far, Gorbachev quickly retreated to the tone of celebration and absolute self-confidence. Neither the grossest errors nor the deviations from the principles of socialism that were committed could turn our people and our country from the path they embarked upon in 1917. The socialist system and the quest and experience which it has tested in practice are of universal human significance. It has offered to the world its answers to the fundamental questions of human life and appropriated its humanist and collectivist values, at the center of which stands the working man. In October 1917, we departed the old world and irreversibly rejected it. We are traveling to a new world, the world of communism. We shall never deviate from this path. And, the transcript tells us, prolonged and stormy applause. At the time, many historians in the West called the speech a huge disappointment, if not a sellout. But for all the glaring insufficiencies of the speech, its unwillingness to criticize Lenin, its praise of the brutal collectivization campaign, Gorbachev opened the most important discussion of all. Intellectually, politically, and morally, the speech would play a critical role in undermining the Stalinist system of coercion and empire. The Kremlin's reluctant discovery in 1989 of the secret protocols to the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, which signed over control of the independent Baltic states from Nazi Germany to Moscow, accelerated the liberation of Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia. A roundtable discussion published in Pravda, simply arguing the merits of the 1968 invasion of Prague, came just as hundreds of thousands of Czechoslovaks were demonstrating in Wenceslas Square. The Pravda article confirmed the Kremlin's shifting attitude toward its own past and helped rob the Czech Communist Party of its last shred of legitimacy. The Polish people would learn the truth about the massacres in the forests of Kalinin, Katyn, and Starobelsk, and the origins of their country's subjugation to Moscow. There were dozens of other examples. History, when it returned, was unforgiving. Chapter 5. Widows of Revolution. 2 months after Gorbachev's history speech, my wife, Esther, and I moved from Washington to a two-room apartment on October Square in central Moscow. Number 7 Dobryninskaya Street was a titanic L and had the hulking gravity of Co-op City in the Bronx, but little of its charm. Except for the foreign cars in the parking lot and the armed guards protecting them, the building looked like most others in the city. It was a ruin the day it went up, and it was always threatening to come down. Concrete fell away from the walls in chalky little chunks. The elevator slammed shut like a cattle car door. At $1,200 a month, my masters at the Washington Post were paying hundreds of times more in rent than the average Muscovite did for a similar place. This may be counted as the last vestige of state socialism. The Communist Party bureaucracy that ran the building, an agency of harpies and spooks called UPDK, gouged foreigners for hard currency whenever they could. I once asked if I might have a phone line capable of calling abroad, a maneuver that should cost about $15. This would cost $20,000. UPDK replied. So you had to love them for that. Across the street from us was the city's biggest statue of Lenin, a bronze behemoth that had run the workers' state more than $6 million. It was a glorious thing to see. A mythic wind bulged Lenin's bronze coattails and billowed his trouser legs as he pointed toward the shining future. The city was littered with horrific monuments, and each had its own nickname and local following. The husky statue of the poet Mayakovsky was known as Mr. Big Pants, and the soaring silver phallus paying tribute to the Soviet space program was known as the Impotent Man's Dream. But Lenin was ours, our rendezvous, as in, let's meet near Lenin's left shoe. He was irresistible. Tourists were forever coming to stare up the great man's skirts and take a picture. Nearly 4 years after we arrived, local engineers were measuring Lenin for destruction. The best strategy, they felt, was to saw him off at the ankles and bring him down with a crane. But that's getting ahead of the story. The weather when we arrived was filthy. A drizzly cotton-wool sky, muddy snow humped along the curbs. The ancient cars slogged like hippos along the swampy streets, their movement barely perceptible through the fog. The world of Russia moved in slow motion. A light snow or rain would fall, and the sidewalks would be iced for days. Just to stay upright, you had to walk with a certain slide and push, your feet never quite leaving the ground. Here and there you would see someone, invariably a block-sized babushka, knees sore and numbed from hours waiting on lines, her nerves frayed with the rub and bump of shopping in stores with nothing in them, suddenly slip fiercely, flipping a couple of feet in the air and landing square on her hip. A fall like that could kill you. Usually it just left black and green bruises the size of dessert plates. Soon I had two myself, one for each side, the insignias of a rival. I had imagined a winter out of David Lean's, not Pasternak's, Dr. Zhivago, a cinemascope vista of whiteness and cold. But real winter was endless and foul. A gray slog that began in late September and ended with the even uglier spectacle of late April, known euphemistically as spring. The melting snow, the dun-colored landscape, the buses so caked in mud that you could not see out the windows, the sudden appearance of defeated-looking weeds, all reminded one Russian friend of an old whore disrobing. If the sky was blue over Moscow 10 or 15 days between September and May, it was a lot. Living without light was like living on another planet, another realm. And by the time we'd been there a year, we both felt like mushrooms, mushy and beige. I once asked a painter I knew why he did not emigrate when his work was starting to sell for thousands of dollars in Europe and America. "For the light," he said. The rooms were bugged, of course. Not that we ever saw the mics. But doubting their existence was both stupid and bad form. Stupid because I didn't want to say anything that would get a Soviet friend in trouble. Bad form because I felt that if our offices did not think we were under psychological pressure, we might lose the cost of living allowance. No successor would forgive me that. In the bad old days, a foreigner's apartment was pretty much off-limits to ordinary Soviets. Our predecessors, pre-Gorbachev, would never have dreamed of having Soviet friends over for dinner. The only Soviets you had as guests were people you couldn't stand, low-level officials, shady institutniks, and hack journalists, all of whom were spooks, or at least extremely cooperative with the organs. They were safe. But the prospect of having a real friend show his documents to the militiaman stationed at the compound gate was too grim. Now, under Gorbachev, that was gradually changing. Friends now pointed to the chandelier and said, "I hope the microphone is on, because I have something very important I want to say. Gorbachev sucks. Or doesn't suck. Whatever." Fear was slowly on the way out. As a resident of the October region, a cigar-shaped ward running south along the length of Leninsky Prospect, I thought it wise to visit the men who ran the place. This was something no reporter would ever have dreamed of doing before. But Glasnost, this curious striptease of ideology and language, was now at center stage. With each week another taboo fell to the floor. It hardly mattered that Gorbachev's committee-written speech on history had been an exercise more in evasion than revelation. One day it was all right to know that Stalin was rude, as Lenin put it in his last testament. Then it was all right to know he had slaughtered millions during the collectivization of Ukraine. Gorbachev was also making political performance a form of glasnost. In foreign capitals and Soviet cities, he ordered his limousine to stop, got out on the streets, and worked the crowds. No one had ever seen such a thing. A modern Soviet leader who walked without an aide at each elbow. "Who is Gorbachev's chief supporter?" the joke went. "No one. He can stand up all by himself." The puffy gray men in the lower ranks of the Communist Party, men who had run the cities and towns like feudal princes, were beginning to get the idea that a little contact with the serfs they commanded just might prolong their dominion. And so it was that I was extended a warm welcome to the Regional Communist Party Committee of the October region. "Please come by, Mikhail Kubrin," the party secretary said over the phone, in that extra-casual tone so in vogue in 1988. It was a tone at once nervous and flip, that wanted you to get the idea that these fellows had been doing nothing but chatting up the constituents since the days of Lenin. Then, as a flourish of confidence, Kubrin said, "Bring a notebook." I arrived at the October Regional Party Committee, a gray concrete hulk. In the lobby, an old woman with legs wrapped in elastic bandages mopped the floor with filthy water. She kept missing the same spot over and over. There was the overpowering smell of disinfectant, bad tobacco, and wet wool. This was the winter smell of Russia indoors, the smell of the woman in front of you online, the smell of every elevator. Near an abandoned newsstand, dozens of overcoats hung on long rows of pegs, somber and dark, lightly steaming, like nags in a stable. Suddenly Kubrin appeared, all smiles and handshakes, a real glasnost man. "Welcome, comrade resident," he said. Kubrin led me up a flight of stairs to his office. He was a new-age sort of Soviet leader with a European tie and a good haircut. He was at that middle rank in Moscow where loyal service to the state might bring a trip to the Bulgarian coast in summer. And there, too, was Yuri Larionov, the head of the municipal government apparatus, a meaty fellow with Gorbachevian rhetoric and Brezhnevian brow. Larionov spoke sweetly enough, but his handshake made it clear that he was capable of crushing a Volga sedan, or at least a petty bureaucrat, when and if the occasion demanded. His face was as worn and gray as steel wool. We sat down at a huge table of polished blonde wood. A secretary, jittery and quick, served tea and cookies all around. She set down a chipped amber bowl filled with the wrapped candies produced down the road by the Red October chocolate factory. "Well, what is it you would like to know?" Larionov said, smiling and rolling his candy wrapper into a tight little spear. "To tell you the truth," I said, "I come as a resident as well as a reporter. I'd love to know why every year you shut off the hot water in the district for a month, a whole month at least. The heat is nothing to write home about, either." This tack was known at the time as exploring the limits of glasnost. Larionov leaned forward in his chair and smiled the smile of a hungry cheetah spotting a gazelle with a sprained ankle. "I'm glad some of our foreign friends live in our district," he began. "But, sir, if you write a lousy article, we'll not only turn off your hot water, we'll turn off your lights and turn your sewage pipes around." We all laughed, but it was clearly time to change the subject. The talk turned to the trials of running a city district of 230,000 people, 44 schools, 11 technical colleges, the Academy of Sciences, the Gubkin Institute of Oil and Gas, the Red Proletariat Machine Tool Factory, to say nothing of the chocolate plant. Like every politician I have ever known, the men of the October region wanted you to feel sorry for them, to feel for a moment their terrible burden. And for the next hour or so, the two of them, Larionov and Kuprin, whined about their common plight. For the first time, people were calling them on the phone and complaining about the garbage pickups that never came, the 10-year waiting lists for a phone, the 15-year waiting list for an apartment. There was a couple, divorced for more than 5 years, calling to say that they were forced to live together in a one-room apartment, and if the party couldn't find them another room somewhere, the party would have blood on its hands, as if it needs more of it. You pigs, goodbye. The two of them, Larionov and Kubrin, sighed magnificently. I mentioned that there had been a great many articles in the press about the privileges of the party apparatus, the cars, the apartments, the vacation retreats. This was not the right thing to say, apparently. "The only privilege we have," Larionov said angrily, "is working weekends, and the privilege of people calling us on the phone and telling us we are petty bureaucrats. And that is not the worst thing they say." "Not the worst," Kubrin said, his head in his hands. "Not the worst thing at all." It was not easy getting the feel for Moscow that winter of our arrival. One freezing morning, Esther and I decided to visit the Kremlin churches. We took the metro to the Lenin Library. As we were coming out of the train, I saw a man with no legs pushing himself along on a dolly cart. What hell it was to live disabled in Moscow. No ramps, elevators that gave out every other day. You hardly saw anyone on crutches or in a wheelchair, though. The state packed most of them off from childhood and stuck them in internats, dismal homes outside of town. And now this man was wrist-deep in slush, the commuters rushing around him or bumping him with their knees and net shopping bags stuffed with potatoes and beets. His face, angular with a slight gray beard, seemed familiar. I thought I remembered his picture from an old book about the dissident movement. I badly wanted to write something about the disabled and began to introduce myself. But before I could go on much further, he said, "Help me up these stairs, would you? There is a demonstration in 15 minutes." As Esther and I helped him, he said he was, in fact, the man in the book, Yuri Kiselyov, the founder of the Initiative Group for the Defense of the Rights of Invalids. When we got to the top of the stairs, Kiselyov pointed to the front of the library and a small crowd milling around. "Well, there they are," he said, "the demonstrators, and the rest of them. This should be something to see." I had no idea what he was talking about. All I could see was some students and passers-by, a few buses parked on the street. "What demonstration?" I said. Yuri rolled over to a slight young man with a black beard who was passing out a mimeographed newspaper. "This is Sasha Podrabinek," Yuri said. Podrabinek had been jailed twice for his protests against the regime's use of psychiatric hospitals as prisons. Now he was editing a unique newspaper called Express Kronika, a mimeographed weekly paper filled with short news items. A taxi driver's strike in Chekhov, an immigration case in Kharkov, a mass rally in Yerevan. It was as if Podrabinek had developed an underground Associated Press in a country that had never had such a thing. All week long, he and his staff took dictation from their far-flung correspondents. On Saturday mornings, when the police were not too much in evidence, Podrabinek passed out his paper on the Arbat and in Pushkin Square. "You see those people on the top step?" Podrabinek said now. "They're Crimean Tatars. At noon they're going to unroll a banner." It was a strange feeling, as if we had wandered onto a back lot at Universal or Moss Film, and we were waiting for the crew to fix the lights before the big scene. Podrabinek turned to the street. "Now, see those yellow buses," he said, "with the tough guy sitting in them? They're all KGB and hired goons. Just before noon, they'll come out and try and stop the whole thing. We were all standing on the library plaza, glancing from one side to the other. I checked my watch. It was 11:58. The KGB made the first move. An officer in an enormous blue overcoat and black felt boots climbed out of the first bus, three others trailing behind him. Surrounded now by KGB men, Podrobinek lowered his voice and continued narrating for my education this sidewalk guerrilla theater. Watch how they circle behind the tatters. Notice the cameras. The lead officer tried to dip his head closer to listen. One of the other agents lifted his lapel to his mouth and started muttering. "Would you like me to talk a little louder for your microphone?" Podrobinek said. The agent did not smile. He looked down and spotted Kiselyov on his cart. "You are anti-Soviet, aren't you?" he said. We all waited for Yuri's answer. "It's you who are anti-Soviet," he said. Then the officer pointed to the tatters waiting for the noon bell on the library steps. They were just a few of the many thousands who had been deported during the Stalin era, all under the pretense that they had supported Hitler during the war. Stalin wanted to destroy any sort of national movement or feeling in the Soviet Union in his quest to create a Soviet man. He was prepared to kill him to do it. Gorbachev, for his part, told his comrades on Revolution Day that all this had been a triumph. Multinational harmony had been achieved. "Why do you bother with them?" the officer asked me, this time using a confiding between us sort of tone. "It's their problem, not yours." At noon, the KGB plainclothesmen, goonish young men with strips of orange cloth tied around their sleeves, poured out of the buses. A few started snapping pictures with Instamatics, and one guy panned the scene with a Sony video camera. Now the protesters took their cue as well, unfurling a banner that read, "Let us go back to our homeland." The officer told them they were in violation of a recent order of the Moscow Communist Party banning demonstrations without authorization. "They denied us permission," one of the Tatars said. "Then that's it," the officer said, throwing up his hands and signaling to his charges. The KGB men ripped the banner to shreds. The tatters did not put up much of a fight as they were led away to the buses. Meanwhile, another officer demanded our passports and documents and wrote it all down. Then the officers with the cameras took our pictures. The whole demonstration lasted no more than 3 minutes. Esther and I tried to flag down a cab with Podrobinek and Kiselyov. We waited a long time, and no taxi. After a while, one of the KGB officers came up behind us and, sweet as could be, said, "You might have better luck getting a cab on the other side of the street." Then he walked away. Kiselyov laughed and said, "The KGB want us to think they're just people with a job to do." The protesters were kicked out of Moscow. Most of them went back to Tashkent, the capital of Uzbekistan, where their families had been shipped in railroad cars in 1944. They were planning another series of demonstrations for the spring. But for all the demonstrations and local politics in those early days of Glasnost, the greatest changes so far were not on the streets, but on the pages of the weeklies Moscow News and Ogonyok, the thick journals Novy Mir and Znamya, and in those tentative but startling speeches of Mikhail S. Gorbachev. Reading was the thing. Every day the papers were filled with the ghoulish and the heartbreaking. Novels were serialized in the monthly journals after a wait of decades. History and literature were now breaking news. It would be a mistake to think that the outpouring of articles, the publication of long-banned books and poems, was a phenomenon limited to the Moscow and Leningrad intelligentsia. The truth was that by the time Zhivago and Brodsky and all the rest came out, the intellectuals had already read them in Samizdat editions. The fiction writer Tatyana Tolstaya told me. For Tolstaya, glasnost meant that she no longer had to hide her foreign books in her ground-floor flat in central Moscow. Glasnost, she said, is wonderful for the intelligentsia, but first and foremost it is a revolution for the proletariat. What was really incredible in 1988 and 1989 was to ride the subways and see ordinary people reading Pasternak in their sky-blue copies of Novy Mir, or the latest historical essays in the red and white Znamya. For a couple of years, stokers, drivers, students, everyone consumed this material with an animal hunger. They read all the time, riding up escalators, walking down the streets, reading as if scared that this would all disappear once more into the censor's black box. A people that had been deprived for so long of all that was best in their language consumed classics on the installment plan. Anna Akhmatova's Requiem 1 week, Andrei Platonov's Chevenger the next. So many people would read one copy of Novy Mir that they would have to wrap it in a makeshift book cover to protect it from fraying. Often they used Pravda, giving it, at last, a worthy purpose. A few foreigners also had places in that early pantheon, especially the British historian Robert Conquest for his work on the purges, and, most of all, George Orwell for his uncanny description of the totalitarian state. People read 1984 for the first time, and they discovered that Orwell, who got his education at Eton and on the streets of colonial Burma, understood the soul, or soullessness, of our society better than anyone else, the philosopher Grigory Pomerantz told me. In the dailies, there were articles on prostitutes, drug addicts, KGB informers, hippies, motorcycle gangs, nudists, mass murderers, rock stars, faith healers, and beauty queens. And all of it was new. No one had ever read anything like it. The weekly Ogonyok was publishing startling stuff on the war in Afghanistan by Artyom Borovik, a journalist in his late 20s who used his connections to get to the front. His father, Genrik, had a more than passing relationship with both the KGB and Gorbachev himself. While his father was working as a journalist in New York, Artyom was prepping at the Dalton School. Artyom's English was as good as it gets. He said his models for his reports on the troops in Afghanistan were Michael Herr's book on Vietnam, Dispatches, and Hemingway's Journalism from the Front. Eventually he wound up with freelance assignments from Life and an on-air job with 60 Minutes. For a reader, the hardest business was dealing with political prose. Until the very end, the prose of the Communist Party and its journalistic organs was clogged with the Novayaz, the newspeak, formed over dozens of years, great clots of language that had no purpose other than meaninglessness, the putting off of meaning, the softening of meaning. Gorbachev had given his crucial speech on history, showing an uncanny ability to go on, for paragraphs, in the language of ritual. Unforgettable days of October. A new epoch of human progress and the true history of mankind. Mankind's hour of genius and its morning dawn. The rightness of the socialist choice made by October. A higher form of social organization. This was language from the Newspeak appendix of Orwell's novel. Gobs of pseudo-elevated language that expressed the sentiments of almost no one. Gorbachev was still operating in the hermetic culture of the Communist Party, a world in which the leader had only to communicate to the members of the party, and especially its leaders. To speak directly and honestly to the people about the true state of deterioration in the Soviet Union would have been to risk the fury and revenge of the nomenclatura. The people hardly listened anymore to the old clichés. Who, after all, still believed that a new epoch of human progress began in October 1917? Certainly not the farmers of southern Russia, humping hay on their backs while their tractors lay rusting in the mud. Who believed this was a higher form of social organization? Certainly not the workers and patients at the hospital in Krasnoyarsk, where the head physician said that the only way to get needles was to scrape the rust off the old ones and use them again. No, this was the old ritual in which the leadership spoke a dead language, a colorless, lying Latin, and the people spoke the vulgar tongue. The party language had a ruinous effect on Russian, so much so that when people heard a speech by Sakharov, one of the first things they would comment on, even before the inevitable wisdom of it, was the purity of his Russian. Orwell would have loved that. In the history speech, Gorbachev was also capable of self-deception. "Comrades," he said, "we justly say that the nationalities issue has been resolved for our country." That sentence alone reflected the party's most suicidal illusion, that it had truly created a Soviet man, a multinational state in which dozens of nationalisms had all dissolved. Within a year, events in Yerevan, Vilnius, Tallinn, and beyond would prove otherwise. At least in public, Gorbachev seemed to have no idea of where events would lead, no idea even what the general movement of history was. "In October 1917, we departed the old world and irreversibly rejected it," he said. "We are traveling to a new world, the world of communism. We shall never deviate from this path." Prolonged and stormy applause. In retrospect, it appears that the speech was a crucial moment in the intellectual and political history of the empire's decline and fall. But at the time, Gorbachev seemed intent on replacing a clearly odious, untenable official history with a more liberal one, a model that proposed revised catchwords and icons for his stated goal, reforming socialism. Looking at the period after Lenin's death, Gorbachev saw an opportunity lost, a dream betrayed. His rejection of Stalinism and embrace of socialist alternatives was the basis of his original vision, as well as the long-held hope of an entire generation of party officials and intellectuals who became idealists during the Khrushchev thaw. These shesti desyatniki, men of the 60s, were half-brave, half-cynical careerists, living a life in waiting for the great reformer to come along and bring Prague Spring to Moscow. While they took few of the risks of the dissidents, the best of them refused to live the lie and found subtle ways of declaring at least a measure of independence from the regime. Some hurt their careers by refusing to join the party. Others joined research institutes or publications in the provinces or Eastern Europe, where they could express themselves a bit more freely. They kept something alive within themselves. When Gorbachev took power, he put members of this thaw generation in positions of power. They edited key newspapers and magazines, led influential academic institutes, and even made policy recommendations to the leadership. For about a year after the speech, Gorbachev was the country's principal historian, and he wanted to control the flow of revelations, keep them within certain bounds. Yuri Afanasyev, the rector of the Historical Archives Institute, soon discovered that while archives on the Stalin era were forthcoming, papers critical of Lenin and other first-generation leaders were not. A popular documentary released in early 1988, More Light, made a demon of Stalin, but trod lightly around Lenin and the Red Terror. Later, Gorbachev's party ideologist, a dense character named Vadim Medvedev, told reporters there was no way the Politburo could allow publication of Solzhenitsyn, especially considering the anti-Leninist heresies in the Gulag Archipelago and Lenin in Zurich. In its way, Gorbachev's schematic view of the Soviet past was as ideologically driven, though not nearly as pernicious, as the old party version. To legitimize his plans for a liberalized socialism, Gorbachev and his generation in the party intelligentsia even created a new set of icons. They emphasized the late Lenin of the less draconian new economic policy of the early 1920s. Khrushchev as the initiator of the anti-Stalinist thaw. Yuri Andropov as a general secretary of the party and technocratic reformer who died too soon. And perhaps most of all, Nikolai Bukharin, the relatively flexible Bolshevik ideologist who was executed by Stalin in the purges. Gorbachev, as general secretary of the party, had no choice but to find a Lenin of his own. But if Gorbachev intended to appear the humanist party man, a Soviet Dubček, he could not look to the fury of Lenin's State and Revolution, or his bloody-minded letters and cables. "We must kill more professors," after the Bolshevik coup. To highlight a slightly more forgiving spirit in the Leninist canon, Gorbachev's circle leaned on a few late essays, such as On Cooperation, and Better Fewer, But Better, in which Lenin seemed willing to endorse a less centralized, coercive economic and political system. Gorbachev's Lenin was represented perfectly in the historical plays of Mikhail Shatrov, Dictator of Conscience, and Onward, Onward, Onward. In those plays, Lenin was the infinitely wise and patient revolutionary, humane, willing to change. Lenin as both mensch and ubermensch. Khrushchev represented good intentions betrayed by political stupidity. He was the bumptious peasant who dared to undercut the Stalin cult, but then lost his way in the 1960s with a series of capricious decisions that so upset the conservatives in the Politburo that they overthrew him. Until the moment of the August coup, Gorbachev remained obsessed with the example of Khrushchev, repeating to his aides, as if it were a mantra, that the most expensive mistakes are political mistakes. He would try to balance forces, stay in the middle, and survive. He would be wiser than Khrushchev and finish the vague, improvisational reform he had begun. Andropov, the KGB chief before he became general secretary, was important to Gorbachev for two reasons. First, Andropov believed that the first step toward an efficient working socialism was to eliminate cheating, loafing, and double-dealing in the workplace and the bureaucracy. As a KGB man, he knew just how deep the problem was, and he was prepared to do something about it. In his short reign, Andropov upset the hardcore Brezhnevites by firing the lazy and arresting a few of the corrupt. The second reason was Andropov's unstinting promotion of the career of Mikhail Gorbachev. Andropov greased Gorbachev's graduation from provincial secretary to the Central Committee, and he never stopped campaigning on Gorbachev's behalf. As he was dying of kidney disease at a hospital for the Kremlin elites, Andropov even dictated a testament to be read to the Central Committee, asking that his protege assume his powers in his absence. But as Andropov's aide, Arkady Volsky, told me, the party elders made sure that the testament was never revealed at the Central Committee plenum, and another party mummy, Konstantin Chernenko, won the post instead. "Kostya will be easier to control than Misha," one of the Politburo members said as he left the room where they had settled the issue. For Gorbachev, the most meaningful new icon of all was Nikolai Bukharin. While Gorbachev was on vacation and writing his history speech, one of his aides sent him a copy of a biography of Bukharin written by a historian at Princeton University, Stephen Cohen. There was no Soviet biography of Bukharin at the time. His name was mentioned officially only as a criminal, a backslider. Cohen's book takes the view that Bukharin represented the road not taken, a more liberal alternative to Stalinist socialism. Such a figure could only be attractive, even an inspiration to Gorbachev and many other reformers of his age in the party and among the intellectuals. The Bukharin alternative showed that all was not lost, that the line from Marx to Lenin did not lead necessarily to economic failure and genocide, to Stalin. Bukharin had forcefully rejected Stalin's Genghis Khan plans and endorsed a far less brutal collectivization, a more mixed economy, and a limited pluralism. He was no Democrat, but no butcher either. His ascent, unlikely as it was, would not have led to a civilized state necessarily, but it might have saved countless lives. Although he spoke of mass-producing, standardized socialist intellectuals as if in a factory, Bukharin was also remembered as the one party leader willing to protect the poet Osip Mandelstam from the secret police. In his Revolution Day speech, Gorbachev broadcast what seemed to be a series of mixed signals on Bukharin. Bukharin and his supporters, in their calculations and theoretical attitudes, effectively underestimated the significance of the time factor in the construction of socialism in the 30s, meaning that Stalin was right to enforce an accelerated push to collectivize the farms and build gargantuan industrial plants in the Urals, northern Kazakhstan, and elsewhere. But then, later in the speech, Gorbachev said, "In this connection, it is worth recalling the description of Bukharin given by Lenin. Bukharin is not just a most valuable and major theoretician of the party. He is also legitimately considered to be the favorite of the whole party. But his theoretical outlook can only be regarded with very great doubt as being fully Marxist, for in him there is something of the scholasticist. He has never learned dialectics, and I don't think he has ever fully understood it." There it was, the breakthrough compliment, appropriately outfitted in Leninist language, and then the ridiculous modification. As if there were more than a dozen men in the Palace of Congresses who had an idea, or gave a damn, what dialectics meant. In a cramped apartment in South Moscow, a woman in her 70s watched the history speech on television. She listened carefully to Gorbachev's every word, and when she heard the word Bukharin,